Welcome to another episode of Negotiation. Today is a very special conversation for me. Negotiation is often described as the art of getting a better deal. But what if negotiation could become something much bigger? What if it became the science of creating value, building trust, and helping both sides leave the table stronger than before? My guest today has dedicated decades of his life to answering exactly that question. Professor Kelt Jansen is one of the world's leading negotiation thinkers. He is an internationally recognized speaker, researcher, TEDx speaker, author of more than 25 books published around the world, and the creator of the award-winning Smartnership negotiation approach. His work combines negotiation, behavioral economics, trust research, and more recently, artificial intelligence in ways that challenge many traditional negotiation models. His newest developments, including NegoDNA or NegoDNA, explore how technology may help us better understand negotiation behavior while reminding us that successful negotiations will always remain deeply human. Kelt, it is truly an honor to welcome you to Negotiation. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kelt, after everything you've learned about negotiation, what have negotiations taught you about being human?
That's a great question. First and foremost, I think we should take a step back. And I think you and I can easily agree that life is about negotiations. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that has become kind of a mission for me is to educate the world of understanding the importance of negotiation. I think in all fairness that kids in elementary school should start learning negotiation because it's such a huge part of everything from relationship with your family, your spouse, your kids, your neighbors, your insurance companies, the authorities. You know, it's a negotiation all the time. And, you know, I still find here in 2026, Christian, so many people, you know, when I'm sitting at a dinner party and people are asking, what are you doing? And I say, well, I'm an advisor in negotiation. And then I meet a lot of people who says, well, I never negotiate, you know, so there's still this perception among millions of people that I don't negotiate. And it's interesting to me because, you know, when I start explaining what negotiation is and isn't, then everybody agree within 5 minutes, oh, I do negotiate a lot. But it's just interesting to me that so many people don't see that. So I think one of the important things for you and I and people like us that we really try and raise the awareness of negotiation. Because when you just look around us, I don't think the world is doing that well. And part of the reason is, now I'm being rude, but we have some horrible negotiators that are sitting sometimes in very, very important situations where the ego get in the way, right? And that's not a very competent, capable negotiator, obviously. So I'm sorry, it's a very long answer to your question, but I could talk about this for hours. I think it's really a human capability. It's something that is essential for us as human beings to understand the psychology and purpose of negotiation.
Mm-hmm. Great. And if the answer is great, then it's okay when the answer is wrong. It takes time. So, okay, let us start with your person. Who was Kelt Jansen before becoming Dr. Kelt Jansen?
I was an unconsciously incompetent negotiator.
Me too.
And you know, that's a nice place to be because you don't know what you don't know, right? Very briefly, I was an executive in a public tech company. I was the head of this rather big company, and I thought I was a great negotiator because, you know, I built up a nice career. I was doing great. The company was doing well. So I thought, hey, I must be a great negotiator. And then we actually hired my partner who founded the organization all the way back in 1976 in Stockholm in Sweden. And he came in. I never forget it. I'm not exaggerating my story. In less than 2 hours, he moved me from being unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. And that was a horrible wake-up call because suddenly I realized, do you know what? I'm a horrible negotiator. And I've never had any formal training in negotiation. I never read a book on negotiation before I met him. And that made me realize, this was specifically in 1998, and that made me realize perhaps I'm not the only executive in the world who are just negotiating based on experience or based on what you think is right and wrong. So I changed career right there and then, jumped ship and left the tech industry to move into the negotiation advisory business where I've been since and worked together with my partner. Simply because I had a moment where I realized, as we just talked about, this is so important, and we have so many people walking around out there who is just doing it without knowing what they're doing, really, including myself.
In Germany, we say for that unbewusste incompetence, unconscious incompetence, and that's the comfort zone. That's the comfort zone. And if you don't know that you could know something else, you are staying there and you think you're the best, but that's a myth.
I think, Kristen, if I could add one thing I'm advocating a lot for. I think the world of negotiation is full of opinions and less facts. I think there's so many people, when we look on social media, that have opinions about negotiation. And some of them are right, obviously. But there's a lot of people just have opinions, which is not based on research facts.
Right.
I'm a strong believer in research facts, something that has been researched, something we can prove, something that has been documented.
Yeah.
And back to myself, because I'm no better than anybody else. Back in 1998, if you asked me about negotiation, I would have a ton of opinions, but they could all be wrong because they're just based on my experience. And my experience may work for me, but they may not work for you or 1,000 other people, right? So I get a little bit annoyed almost every day on LinkedIn when I see somebody, so-called expert, coming out there and sharing an opinion about negotiation. Again, as I said, sometimes they're right, but they could be wrong. And then they're spreading the wrong info to somebody else. So I'm often asking people, Christian, if you're building a bridge, would you like to have the engineer building it based on opinions or research fact? You know, it's obvious. So why is negotiation different? Why do we listen to opinions and not research fact? I think that's an important milestone for me as well, to educate everybody to actually look back at, where's the information coming from? Is it somebody's opinion, or is it something that is actually factual?
That's a really important thing. Often they don't tell you facts, but they tell you sentences that started with, "You must, you have to." And in a negotiation, I don't have to, and I'm not, I don't have to do things, because I have to watch what says the science, and after that, which strategy is the best. It's always also the problem, what's better, Harvard program or the FBI's program. And I did an interview with Gary Nesner from the FBI, and he told me I'm a lousy business negotiator. But I can negotiate about relationship management and relationship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes?
And
absolutely.
So, and in my opinion, it's both, but it has to be we don't
completely
have to
agree.
Forget the science. Yeah.
Completely agree. I think if I could add a comment to that, you know, I often say, Christian, if somebody called me and said, there's a hostage negotiation going on 3 streets from here, could you come and help out? I would say, no, I can't, because I have no idea how to deal with the hostage negotiation. And the same thing goes when you look at hostage negotiators. I admire what they're doing. I think it's amazing. But you should not put them into a business commercial context, because they don't know what they're doing in there. Just like I don't know what I'm doing in a hostage negotiation. So we have to realize that there are so many directions in negotiations as well. And I call myself a commercial negotiator. That means I'm focused on data and numbers and values and profit and all of that. So that's my angle into negotiation. Then you have negotiators who are really good at conflict handling, and you have negotiators who are good at hostage negotiation, and you have negotiators that are good at political negotiations. But it's very different areas. And obviously, I'm not that bright, because I can't cope with all of that. I just have to focus on one thing. And I think that goes for quite a lot of people.
Yeah, true. Yes. Was there a negotiation early in your life that completely changed the way you think about people?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I would actually say the negotiation I had with my former partner when he joined us, that was a revelation to me, because he was using all the toolbox himself that he later told me. So that was a remarkable wake up call for me, when I suddenly realized all the stuff I've missed out previously. Mm-hmm. So that was a lesson learned in real time.
Yeah, a lot of motivation starts then.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you often speak about trust. Is trust something that exists before negotiation, or something that can actually be negotiated?
Yes, that wonderful question again, Christian. I would say, first and foremost, often when I talk about trust, and I talk about trust all the time, I meet clients and students who says that, Yeah, trust is a nice thing to have. And then I stop them, interrupt and say, you know what? It's not a nice thing to have. It's a needed thing to have. Because what I have found, and I did my doctorate studying trust in negotiation, and my purpose was to try and quantify trust. And thank God I was lucky-good because we succeeded in doing that. And we actually found that in negotiation with a high level of trust, you capitalize more than 30% more value than in negotiation with a low level of trust. So we could prove in our study that trust is not a nice thing to have. We can quantify trust. It has a monetary value. So that's why I have renamed trust in negotiation into trust currency. So I just put the two words currency and trust together because it is a monetary value. Back to your question. Trust is something that you have to negotiate as well. And what I often say, Christian, that sometimes provoke people is you should put trust on the agenda. So besides having, you know, welcome, who's who, what are we going to talk about today? What is the purpose? There should be an item called trust. And the reason I find that this sometimes provoke people is because people are saying, well, we can't talk about trust. And I say, why not? You know, since it's so essential and it carries a huge value, why shouldn't we be able to talk about trust? So if you and I were negotiating, Christian, I would say to you, if you feel that trust is declining in our relationship, please tell me. And I should be allowed to do the same because we have to correct then, because I'm not purposely trying to reduce trust. I want trust to be as high as possible. But if I say something or do something I'm not aware of, please let me know because I have an interest just like you in keeping trust as a high level as possible. You know, we can all agree, I think, that trust is something that takes some time to create and we can lose it in a second, right?
Yes.
But instead of just playing games in negotiation, and I'm not a fan of playing games or using tactics or manipulating or whatever you have, I think negotiation is about creating and distributing value. So to me, negotiation is kind of a puzzle that you and I work out together. So it's not about beating you or beating me. It's about figuring out the puzzle together. And then we won against the game. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of while we're negotiating. And we can only succeed in doing that if we are transparent without becoming naive and have a certain level of trust in each other. I'm not saying we should become naive. I'm just saying trust will generate more value. I even don't know if I answered your question right there. I just got off on something.
That's great. And it tells a lot about the negotiator's dilemma because the less trust you have, less information you give to the other person. Yes,
absolutely.
And that's a problem. Yeah. So great answer.
And will it always work? Of course not. You'll have a situation where trust is low.
Yes.
It's very hard to generate trust. And then obviously you have to make up your mind. Do I want to do business with that counterpart or not?
Yes. And sometimes you have a FOTI situation, full open truthful exchange. There are different situations and you have to look at each negotiation situation.
Yes.
So what is the biggest mistake even experienced negotiators continue to make?
Oh, how many hours do we have, Christian? I think it seems very simple, and it really is. But I would say I keep coming back to the same thing. People are not listening and asking questions.
Yeah.
They're not listening to what you're really saying. So let me give you an example. If you come to me and say, Kel, I want to change delivery time by 3 weeks. I may be answering, no, I can't do that. Or I might say, okay, we can do that. Both of them are wrong. What I should do is actually listening to what you're saying and replace the sound of the word with the sound of a cash register. Because when you're raising an interest, you're having a financial value in changing that variable. So my response to you should be, oh, that's interesting, Christian. What is the value to you if we change that delivery time? And now my purpose as a negotiator is figuring out what is your value versus my cost. Mm-hmm. Now, if your value is higher than my cost, we have generated what I call negotiation economics, negoeconomics, which is the asymmetric value. And I should be happy taking on a cost if your value is higher than my cost and you're willing to compensate my cost. Thereby, we create that value. Yeah. Back to your question, what is the biggest mistake? The biggest mistake is a lot of people are egocentric. So they're sitting there thinking with their papers, oh, if we change the delivery time, that will cost me €500,000. And then I just say no. And I'm not even considering what your value might be. My colleague from Harvard University, Dan Shapiro.
She's one of my teachers.
Great. He's great, one of my superstars. I love him. Yes, he's great. He's outstanding. And one of the things Dan has been talking about, and you probably heard that from him as well, is that he called about the tribal effect. You know, we all tribal. That means that if you and I agree on something, we have a hard time accepting somebody that are disagreeing with you and I, right? And that is a problem. I know we're always blaming social media, but that's a problem that social media and algorithm have just increased because we're getting feeded with everything that just agrees with your opinion.
Yeah.
And that's a problem in negotiation as well, because I think disagreement is healthy. That is where we develop that additional value. If we just agreed on everything, that would be horrible. My God, it would be boring, right? And we wouldn't create that asymmetric value. So anyway, long answer to your question. Listening and asking questions would be two of the key things I would advise most negotiators to be aware of.
Yeah. And now we come, probably to your life's work. If you had only 3 minutes or five to explain smartnership to someone who's never heard about it, what would you tell them?
Yeah. What I sometimes find is that some negotiation philosophies in the world is just trying to make the horse and the buggy run faster, if you know what I mean. We are trying to change that and creating the car. What we're doing really is trying to have people rethink what negotiation is and isn't. So we are not so focused on just giving you more tools and more techniques and more tactics to win your negotiation or outmaneuver the counterpart. We are starting about talking about what is negotiation. And we actually have a term called role of engagement, where we're talking about that we have to negotiate on how to negotiate before we negotiate. And, you know, often when I say that, Christian, people look at me like I'm crazy, but I'm serious about it because people perceive negotiation very differently, right? You may see negotiation like playing tennis. I may perceive negotiation like playing chess. So when we meet up and have not pre-negotiated on how to negotiate, you start playing your game and I start playing my game. And we could be doing this for hours or days before we figure out how to play together. And why not just verbalize that back to what we talked about trust, right? Why not just verbalize that and say, hey, Christian, I would like to talk about how we're supposed to negotiate today. Are we going to be open and transparent? What are the variables we need to discuss? Are you willing to share your cost and your benefit? And so on and so forth. So smartership is about changing the mindset of how we negotiate. So if we divide the role, you know that as well. We often talk about we have positional negotiation and collaborative negotiation. So we talk about zero-sum games, partnership, and then we added smartnership. Because people often get confused about partnership. I mean, I've been doing this for many years. And often when I ask an organization, what is your official approach to negotiation? I meet so many organizations that says, oh, partnership. And when you really dig in and try to figure out what they're doing to suppliers or clients, they're really just doing zero-sum, but has been repeatedly doing zero-sum for 6 years, and then they call it partnership. That's not a partnership, obviously, because it's not collaborative. So that means we also called it partnership version 2.0, but smartnership is just an add-on to partnership. So you could say the big difference between smartnership and partnership is trust, the trust currency part we just talked about. It is necroeconomics, as we just talked about. It is role of engagement, discussing the rules of the game, how we should negotiate. And fourth and final, it's about creating a strategy. And we could ask your listeners right now, how many of you have an official negotiation strategy in your organization? I bet you that majority don't. And this is one of the other things that we argue when we look at organizations that are more successful than others. They have created a strategy, just like they have a research and development strategy or go-to-market strategy or sales strategy or communication strategy or HR strategy or, you know, all the other strategies that business school have taught us that we need, but they don't have a negotiation strategy. Anyway, that was the short version of what is smartership.
Yeah, very cool. And that's true. In Germany, many, many companies don't have that.
I see that all over the world. It's you know, when I sit with a group of people, let's say 50 executives in a room, and I ask them, raise your hand if you have a negotiation strategy. I usually get about four or five that raise their hand. And then I ask them about a strategy, and half of them are wrong. It's not a strategy, it's a tactic they're explaining. Yeah. So you might have two organizations out of 50 who actually have a strategy, and we need one.
Yes. And I think also it's very important, the map is not the territory. And before the negotiation, we have to learn about each other to know what is your strategy? What is my strategy? What are we talking about? Yeah, that's very, very important. So I don't know if you answered yet the next question, but maybe concretely, what makes smartnership fundamentally different from the traditional Harvard model?
Harvard and I agree on most of.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a study conducted where five leading negotiation methods in the world were compared on trust creation, value generation, and long-term outcome. And I'm happy to say, I don't want to brag, but SmartNership actually came out as the model that created most value, followed by Harvard.
Cool.
And the model that did worst was Chris Voss. Basically didn't generate a lot of value, and more importantly, did not generate trust. It was actually perceived as a very manipulating approach into negotiation.
He was a pupil of Gary Nesner.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. So I would say, great question. What is the big difference between Harvard and SmartNership? SmartNership is a bit more commercial. We are very focused on numbers, back to negotiation economics. So Harvard model contains a lot of great stuff. I don't really disagree with anything Harvard is doing. I think it's a marvelous organization doing great work. But we just add negoeconomics and are very focused on the asymmetric more than the psychology part of negotiation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah. So I'm very excited because now comes the NEGO DNA. Mm-hmm. And that's cool because I did one. But before that, many people are fascinated and maybe a little concerned about AI entering negotiations.
Right.
What inspired you to create NEGO DNA?
Yes, great question. Let's go back about 2 years. 2 years ago, together with the president of World Commerce and Contracting, Mr. Tim Cummins, we ran a worldwide study on AI. So what we did very briefly was we had 443 teams of two people that were negotiating with each other. Mm-hmm. And we just repeated the study over and over again. And what we did, the short version of it, you can actually download the peer-reviewed research paper called A Friend or Foe for free. So just Google that. But what we did was we had teams negotiating old school with each other. That means without using AI. Then we compared the outcome of the simulation. They all had the same time to prepare and conduct the negotiation, and they were all negotiating the same simulation. Then we had a different negotiation where one side was using AI and the counterpart was not using AI, so there was an unbalance. And then we had the third group where both parties were using AI and both were educated and skilled in using AI. And then we measured the outcome in four different areas. One was a level of preparation. And not a big surprise, the team not negotiating without AI was not really that well prepared. The two teams negotiating with AI were really well prepared. Utilization of time. The old school negotiators without AI always ran out of time. They never managed to reach a deal within the allocated time. The two teams using AI every single time managed to reach a deal within the allocated time. Mm-hmm. Then we looked at value generation, which obviously had a huge interest to me. And old school negotiators left a lot of value on the table. Macroeconomics was basically not captured. The two teams using AI almost captured all the value all the time. And the fourth one, which was really interesting and a big surprise to me, Kristen, I didn't see that coming, but trust, honesty, and transparency went through the roof in negotiation where both sides were using AI.
Wow. Okay.
And when the two teams not using AI were negotiating, they were doing as people are normally doing, you know, hiding numbers, not being transparent, bluffing, lying, what have you. So I've had a lot of people that come to me afterward and say, so are you claiming that AI is helping people become more honest, open, and transparent? And my response is, well, according to this study, that seems to be the case.
Sounds crazy. And,
yes,
and
I agree.
If it's possible to get after the interview, the link, I will put it into the show notes.
Sure.
Because that's really, really cool. And I use AI in negotiations, but I think I also have to learn a lot. But yes, it costs not so much time. And one of my teachers, Professor Michael Wheeler, said also, don't leave value on the table. He said, don't leave money on the table. And and that's the truth. And I think AI helps a lot. But back to NEGO DNA, how does it actually work? So
yeah.
What kind of information does it analyze? How accurate are these predictions? And where also you see the limits?
Yeah, well, I would say I'm a kind of a weird individual because I'm a true believer in relationships between people. I normally say that all business is human. It is Christian and Kel that is doing a business deal. It's not your company and my company. So I do believe in the interpersonal relationship. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm also probably one of the biggest fan of using AI in negotiation, but simply because it's just such a great tool to assist us not only saving time, but capture more value back to our study. So what we did was 8 months ago, we started a project creating the Smartnership Negotiation Copilot that is ready, where NegoDNA is just one part of it. So the copilot basically consists of seven different tools. One is the analyzer where you can upload contracts. It will break down the contract, identify the variables. It will prioritize them into different tiers. Which one of them is generating value? Which one should you focus on? How can you change the language from positional to collaborative? Mm-hmm. You have the Ask Kel module, which is basically kind of a chat box, but based on everything we know about negotiation. And then you have another module, the NegoDNA. Now, NegoDNA is kind of interesting because it basically harvests legally all public available information about you. So it goes to what I do basically is I copy your LinkedIn profile, put it into the system, and in about 60, 70, 80 seconds, it reads your entire LinkedIn profile, your history, your background, your education, your current job, your previous job, and then it compares it to public available data. And based on that, it generates a 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 pages report, basically identifying you as a negotiator. Mm-hmm. Is it accurate? Not always, because it depends on your profile. And I mean, I haven't asked you to do an assessment. I'm just harvesting the public available information about you. I would say it's probably 95% accurate. And I can promise one thing, it's way more accurate than any people just assuming something before stepping into a negotiation. So it gives you a very credible picture of the counterpart before you step in and give you a general idea, who is Christian? I mean, is Christian more dominant? Is he more influential? Will he be trying to dominate, ask the question? Will he be more reluctant? How do I generate trust? What should I do in my communication with Christian? What shouldn't I do? How do I make sure we reach an agreement? So the purpose, again, is not to manipulate. The purpose is to help generate a better communication by trying to understand each other. Mm-hmm. Now, what is funny is that Welcomers and Contracting, the nonprofit organization, just ran a study based on NegoDNA, asking their audience of 80,000 members how they felt about this tool. And the fun part is, Christian, human beings are funny. 89% found that it was okay running it on a counterpart, but only 17% found it would be okay if the counterpart ran it on you. So, you know, it's kind of funny, isn't it?
That's really funny.
Yeah, so people obviously found it awkward if the counterpart were doing it, but it's okay if you run it on somebody else.
Yeah.
Again, it's not for me to get into an ethical discussion whether it is ethical or not. However, I would say NegoDNA don't use any information that you cannot look up yourself. It will just take you a much longer time, and obviously you don't get the same data treatment as it is offering. So it's basically giving a pretty accurate report. But I'm curious, Christian, you got one. How do you see yourself? Are you agreeing or disagreeing or partly agreeing with the content of the report?
I agree. I did it. And I don't know, do you analyze my LinkedIn profile too?
Yes.
Oh, cool. So in my opinion, we cannot avoid evaluating. Mm. So, and that's the first. So I think we build hypotheses. Yes. Mm. And that's science, if we try to understand if is it right or wrong. And yes, I read it, and I'm very excited to hear your opinion about it. I think one sentence was a bit cruel. The single most important thing to know going into the room with Chris, he will build genuine rapport fast and use it strategically. Do not mistake warmth for softness. And yes, it's true, but in my opinion, it's all about attitude and how I use my power.
Sure.
So
sure.
What kind of hypothesis would you probably gonna write about me?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you came out as a people person, right? You were one that likes, appreciate the relationship. I found it. I got it here. You were high on influence. So the relationship for you is obviously kind of important. You also kind of dominant. So you are proactive, communicating. You focus on trust, and your detail level is is, I wouldn't say low, but the lower part. So I should probably not, in a negotiation with you, start with all the data and the details and what have you.
I know people who can this. Yes.
Yeah. And then it focused the trust orientation. So you are an individual that would start with trust, and then if people don't earn that trust, it will decline. But you're not one that start with low trust and then you have to earn your trust. So you're kind of a trusting individual that you like to believe in the good of human beings. Your default negotiation style is empathy, assertive, basically, as we just talked about. So you're into the relation part, and then just goes into what I shouldn't do. For instance, it says here, avoid, don't open in a negotiation with Chris. Don't open with aggressive positional anchors or purely transactional framing. This will activate his legal defenses and close the relational channel. So that it's
yes,
just
yeah,
listing
and
a
so
lot of
on.
Stuff.
But it's really, really great to read this, and people should Google you and should find it if you would like to give it to me. I can put it into the show notes because it's really,
Sure.
really, really interesting. And the most of it I reflected, and it costs a lot of minutes or maybe hours to reflect this professionally. But yeah, in my opinion, it's great. It's another version of the classical DISC model, and in my opinion, it's much deeper. And so, thank you for this model. Great.
Oh,
yes, I'm
absolutely. We actually created a version of it as well that we call the deal table. And it works differently because it works the way that if I know I'm going into a negotiation with you next week, I can go to deal table and fill out my own assessment and then send off an invite to you to do the same. So deal table will reach out to you and say, hi, Chris, would you mind filling this one out? And then we will share the information and we will create a report comparing the two of us. So both of us will have access to the same information, so I can see where we're compatible and where may we get into trouble.
Yes.
And then we're just open about it. So, you know, it's basically like a marriage counseling. We just talk openly about the differences before we get into an actual
And
negotiation.
that builds again trust. Yeah. So, yeah, okay, cool. Very, very, very cool. Thank you for that. And let's come to one of my favorite thing in negotiations. You said it a few seconds ago. It's emotion. And my podcast is called Negotemotion, because I deeply believe every negotiation is emotional before it becomes rational. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. I think all people are irrational, and we make conclusions on emotions, and then we add the fact later on to prove that our emotional decision was absolutely right. I couldn't agree more.
What emotions create the greatest value at the negotiation table?
That's a good question. One of the things that I often tell our clients is that emotions are great and we cannot outrule them because it's part of human beings. However, we also have to be rational because emotions come partly from biases. And the bias is not necessarily correct. You know, I may have a bias against certain people, let's say engineers. I think engineers are boring, detail focused, and are not open to generate macroeconomics. That's wrong. That's just my bias, right? But it may not be true. But if I got that bias, every time I meet somebody who is an engineer, I will put on that frame thinking they are not able to do whatever. So we also have to be careful with the emotional part. And that's back to AI. Part of the reason that I enjoy AI, because for instance, like the negotiation DNA, it becomes more rational because AI, I'm not saying it doesn't have biases, because AI do have biases, but it's less than with human beings. So we can get a more rational challenge to our biases. Why I enjoy AI. Let me give you an example. My wife and I both have temper. So once in a while, we have a fight. Nothing serious. We've been married for a long time, so we survive it every time. But we have a fight about stupid things, like as married couple might have. And I don't know, a year ago, I was thinking, this AI thing, can that actually help in intermarriage issues? So in one of our fight, I called for a break, and I went into my home office, and I typed in the entire situation, her feelings, her emotion, what she was saying, what I was saying, the emotional thing. And AI, this was ChatGPT at that point, came out with the perfect explanation of why she was feeling what she was feeling, why I was feeling what I was feeling, and what we should do. So I just took that solution from ChatGPT, went back into my wife, and 2 minutes later, all the problems were solved. So, you know, AI can actually take an angle like a you know, like therapy, and really help us out understand not only ourselves and the counterpart. I often meet people that say, well, AI don't have emotions. No, it's true, don't have emotion, but that doesn't mean it can't read emotions. And quite often it is more objective in reading emotions than I am, because, you know, if I'm in a fight with my wife, I'm not objective. I'm obviously thinking she's wrong and I'm right, right? You know, so AI can help us a lot. So talk about that, Chris. And I actually just saw a study recently saying that the number one use of AI here in the US is self-therapy. So people are sitting at home using AI to deal with themselves.
Yes, and self-therapy, I think that's very dangerous to talk to yes. talk only with the AI about this. But for your example, it's great. It's one of the greatest right. things if we have VLAN. So we people also have to do something, and we have to know things if we don't have internet. So
yes.
What role does empathy play in high stakes negotiations for you?
One of the things that I'm a big speaker in favor of having more women negotiating globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I see high stake negotiation globally, it's almost, I don't know if you have Find Wally in Germany, that, you know, that cartoon where you have to find the character that is dressed in a certain way. It's a kid's book. So you have to look at all these pictures with hundreds of people, and then you have to find that one individual. Yeah. Find Waldo is the name of it.
Yeah.
And I call it Find Waldo because when you look at high stake international negotiations, finding a woman in that group is like looking for Find Waldo. You know, there might be one out of 20 men, but that's about it. The reason I'm talking about this is that I think, and I'm generalizing, that women are better negotiators than men. Obviously, I'm generalizing. But I think they have a lot of capabilities that men don't. And one of them is empathy. Men has a gene, and I'm generalizing now, that makes us competitive. So we often step into a negotiation thinking, I want to win. And the consequence could be that I win, but lose the relations. Mm-hmm. Or I win right now, but lose the long-term reaction. Women, and again, I'm generalizing, have a tendency to have a higher empathy, understanding and trying to understand the counterpart more than men.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I'm saying that is, again, a long answer to your question. I find empathy to be extremely important. And I find that every time I'm sitting with a client where we have a gender mix, so both men and women, they outperform teams every time where it's purely men, and partly because of the empathetic gene that woman puts into that process. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we come to the last four questions. The first one is a very short. If there's one book, what book has changed your life?
The one book that changed my life was actually the original book I read by my the founder of our organization, Mr. Undt, a Swede. Mm-hmm. He wrote his first book on collaborative negotiation in 1976 mm-hmm. In Swedish. It was not published in English. That was probably the book that makes the biggest impact on me, because suddenly I realized, back to what I said, that shoot, I'm a horrible negotiator. I don't understand what negotiation is all about. I would say that I've been reading so many books, but I would say still today, that is one of the books why I put it down and thought, my God, this is a completely different way of looking at how to collaborate, how to negotiate. Mm-hmm.
And I think many, many listeners are inspired after our interview and asks the question, where can listeners learn more about your work, Kjeld? I know there are many, 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 many videos online, but maybe there are some places to find the best things about you.
We do have an online university where people can pick up courses self-paced or live learning. I did a LinkedIn learning course as well that is free if you have a LinkedIn premium account on AI specific, how to use AI in negotiation. We have had close to 13,000 people taking that course in less than a year now, giving it an average rating of 4.7. So either my wife has been in there 13,000 times and giving it a rating, or people actually like it. I don't really know. But that's two of the areas. And obviously, I have a bunch of books that are out that you can pick up and study the content even more. And as you said, there's a lot of free videos out there as well.
Cool. Thank you. So the last two questions. Throughout your remarkable career, have negotiations taught you more about closing deals or about understanding yourself? And what did they reveal?
Both, really. If I should reveal something about myself, I am very dominant and competitive. Mm-hmm. And I get very frustrated if I feel something is unfair. What I learned about myself is that if I sit in a negotiation where I feel this is unfair, I go straight into a very combative mode, which is obviously not healthy. So throughout the process, you learn a lot about yourself as well, both as a negotiator and as a human being. But as back to what you said, Christian, I agree with, since it is a very emotional process, the reaction you have in a negotiation where you might have a disagreement or confrontation is probably part of you that you would see otherwise as well. So that's one of the important lessons that you learn to deal with yourself, right? And you have to improve yourself. And I often say, I'm not competing with anybody else in this world. I'm competing with myself yesterday to become even better tomorrow. That's the real challenge, isn't it? And that's a challenge for life. I mean, you never get
yeah,
perfect,
it's
right?
Never ending.
No. So that's, I've learned a lot about myself in that. But I also learned how to close deals. And I also learned to close deals the right way, because I think there's a right way and a wrong way to close deals. As I said, you can win the deal but lose the relationship, or you can try and win the deal and the relationship. Now, some people think that what I talk about is very softy-softy because I talk about the relationship. I talk about trust. I talk about creating that long-term relationship. But I'm not doing it just because I think we should be nice to each other. I do it because I know we become more profitable. If we look at the famous Dr. Nash, who died mm-hmm. just a few years ago, Dr. Nash, Hollywood found him so interesting, so they even produced a movie about him. Dr. Nash, for those who don't know him, was an American who basically invented game theory, which is an important foundation for negotiation. He was a mathematical genius. He got the Nobel Prize in economics. And if we go even further back in time, back to 1776, there was a Scottish philosopher by the name of Adam Smith who basically wrote the first book on negotiation. It wasn't on negotiation, but it was on how should nation trade with each other? How should organization mm-hmm. do business with each other? And Adam Smith is called the father of modern capitalism because he's saying that you should do only what is good for yourself and not the counterpart. That's the only way you would win. Now, Dr. Nash in the 60s came out and criticized that and said, you know what? Adam Smith is absolutely wrong, because the only way we all win is when you do what's good for yourself and the counterpart at the same time. That's the only way we truly win. Now, Dr. Nash was not a socialist or communist, but he was just doing this purely from a mathematical point of view. And he could prove from a mathematical point of view that you become more wealthy and I become more wealthy if we collaborate, compared to what Adam Smith said, that we should be purely egocentric. Again, long explanation, but I believe in this system, because why would I get hurt if you get more wealthy as long as I don't pay for it? And why would it hurt you if I become more wealthier if you're not paying for it? Back to the concept of necroeconomics.
It's the famous prisoner's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great movie. I think A Beautiful Mind.
Yes, exactly.
So let's look this movie.
Yes.
Dear listeners, it's a great movie.
Yep.
And now maybe it comes a great last question. Mm-hmm. I hope so. So many negotiation experts say that information is power.
Mm-hmm.
My experience as an emotions coach tell me that emotional awareness is power.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to choose only one, which one wins?
Great question. I never got that question in any podcast before. And I would actually say, it sounds a little bit political, but I would say it depends. And what I mean by that is, what negotiation philosophy do you believe in? If you believe in zero-sum positional negotiation, information is power, because it's about winning against the counterpart. If you believe in collaborative negotiation that I believe in, the emotional side is key, because if you understand the counterpart more than the information, you will gain more value out of that. And the information you have is only half of the pie, half of the puzzle, because the counterpart has obviously the other part of that information. And if you don't have the skill to get that information out of the counterpart, and we can just do full circle and get back to your first question where I said things negotiators are missing, the ability to listen and ask questions. If you're not able to do that from an emotional, intelligent approach, you'll be losing out a lot of value and a lot of information. You may walk away mm-hmm. thinking that you won, but what you don't realize is all the information that you didn't get from the counterpart and the value you left on the table.
Okay, so it's both. And it's a similar answer like Suskind asked, is negotiation an art or a science?
Yeah.
And the answer is Yes.
Yes. I think it's true. However, I agree with that. I think it is both. However, in my work, I'm trying to make it more of a science because we can make research, we can document, we can compare approaches to negotiation, and we can see that one approach is better than another. And as long as you can document that from a research point of view, then it becomes science. So,
Very, very fine with it. So I'm really, really happy. Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you for having
you in my podcast. Very, very cool. And I hope if you come someday to Germany, we can see us and you're my guest. So thank you again
so
for this great, great interview. And thank you also for your time, dear Kelt.
Thank you. Thank you, Christian.